This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 10th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 408. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Lori Troutman is the director of the Border Policy Research Institute at Western Washington University. She also co-chairs the Border Issues Working Group for the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. On this edition of the podcast, Lori Troutman joins me from Bellingham, Washington to talk Trump, trade, transportation, security, and soccer. The FIFA World Cup is coming next year to Vancouver and Seattle. Will they be ready to host the world? This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Here we are beyond the halfway point of 2025, more than 6 months of Donald Trump's second presidency. Where do you see the relationship between Canada and the U.S., especially the relationship between the region, between Washington and British Columbia, and how that has fared in the recent months?
It's a really messy time, I think, is the best way for me to think about it. You know, we've got really strong relations, as you mentioned, these north-south connections, trade, travel. We have the third busiest border crossing along the entire Canada-U.S. border right here in our region. And we have really intimate and unique ways we're connected, whether that's supply chain relationships or that's the community of Point Roberts, which is completely dependent on their Canadian neighbors. And I think because of that, we do have a number of institutes, of initiatives that have built up around trying to not just protect that relationship, but advance it further into the future. So, for example, the Border Policy Research Institute, only institute of its kind in the U.S., in that it's dedicated to the study of the Canada-U.S. border, housed at a university. You'd think, given the importance of the relationship, there would be a lot more institutes like ours. But because of the importance of mainly British Columbia to Washington State, the state of Washington established this program 20 years ago. And there's several other examples. We'll probably talk about the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. There's also the Cascadia Innovation Corridor and a couple others. So we have a lot of kind of institutional support to shore up this relationship, but we are facing this really incredibly unprecedented challenge. And I would add that we're facing this challenge at a time when we're still really recovering from the COVID border restriction years, when we had, you know, 90% drop in cross-border travel. We had a lot of businesses sort of reconfiguring whether or not they would be able to invest across the border. And I think we were recovering quite steadily. Our region has bounced back from these shocks over the past, whether that was the recession, that was the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And we've rebounded very quickly. But this is really new territory. And the tough thing, I think, about what we're facing today is it isn't just that we have this challenge and this problem and we move on. It's the challenges and the problems keep popping up and they're so unpredictable that it's hard to get ahead of them and feel like we can move towards sort of repairing the damage versus just stopping the bleeding, for lack of a better analogy.
Now, you look closely at cross-border trade, transportation, security, and human mobility at the Border Policy Research Institute. What data this year in 2025 versus data from 2024 is top of your mind? What evidence that you're seeing in the data that you analyze is top of your mind, as well as what you're seeing with your own eyes on the ground in Whatcom County?
It's a mix because a lot of the data that we would rely on hasn't really played out yet. I mean, we're hearing this a lot in the United States that we're just now starting to feel the impact of tariffs on consumer prices. So there's this delay between the data we would typically look at and this very fast moving situation. One of the simplest metrics we can look at is just the number of border crossings. How many BC cars are crossing the border into Whatcom County. It's a simple measure, perhaps overly simplistic, but it does give us a sense of the trends that impact broader economic situations, broader business investment relations. And what we saw coming out of COVID was this steady recovery. The numbers, as I mentioned, dropped really, really low because of those border restrictions. And it took people a while on both sides of the border to resume that travel. But we were on a steady path to recovery, maybe still around 20% of pre-pandemic normal when it comes to that cross-border travel volume. And that was recovering month over month, including January of this year when the numbers were up, I think, around 15% compared to January of the year before. And then in February, that switched dramatically. And that is directly, I think, tied to the rhetoric of the Trump administration, whether it's the tariff threats, the claims about fentanyl and undocumented immigration, or the comments around the 51st state. We really saw Canadians react with ceasing their travel across the border. And that initial number in February of 2025 compared to 2024 was a drop of around 29%. And then we saw that number grow and it got higher and higher. And by April, we were seeing 50% fewer Canadian cars crossing into Whatcom County than we saw in April of 2024. That's a pretty drastic drop. We estimate around 5,000 vehicles, more or less, which probably translates to roughly 10,000 trips into Whatcom County. That's a lot of trips across the border. It's starting to recover slowly now. And I think summer is really going to be the telling time because that's our peak travel season as it is. I just ran the July numbers yesterday and we're down around 28% compared to July of last year. So we saw this really unprecedented drop early in the winter that seemed to continue to grow as I think Canadians got more and more frustrated and angry. Also border concerns in there as well. A lot of fear by Canadians around crossing the US border. And that seems to kind of be tapering off a little bit. The question is gonna be what happens in August, what happens in September? And is that 30% reduction sort of the new normal we're facing, or will we start to rebound from that as potentially the rhetoric dies down? But again, this is, sort of a glass ball, magic glass ball scenario where the rhetoric could die down, our trade relations could normalize, or it could get worse.
How much of this is directly related to the Trump trade war, and how much of this might also be just economic trends? The U.S. dollar is still high compared to Canadian dollar. The loonie is not as powerful as it has been in recent years. So there's that disadvantage. When you have the currency exchange, there's also gas prices. Mm-hmm. Canadians used to go across the border for cheaper gas, even with the currency disparity. But since the carbon tax was taken off the gas here in Canada, and especially in British Columbia, back in the spring, that has made prices a little easier for Canadians to handle and a lot more competitive when it comes to comparing the price of a liter of gas here in Canada with a gallon of gas in Washington State.
Certainly the economics are not aiding the situation. And here in our region, compared to places like Detroit, Windsor, for example, we know that the majority of travel here is discretionary and the majority of travel here is associated with things like shopping and gas. So the fairly high percentage of people who cross the border here, Canadians exclusively in this case, say their primary reason for crossing the border is to fill up on gas. So as you mentioned, with gas prices more comparable, with the Canadian dollar relatively weak compared to the US dollar, that is certainly, I think, keeping the numbers low. But I don't think that that's the initial reason for the drop. We have this mix of factors. And we actually just completed a survey with a partner organization here, the Whatcom Council of Governments, binationally funded. BC and Washington and Canada and the US funded this project to survey travelers as they were crossing the border to ask them questions like, where are you coming from? Where are you going? What's your primary trip purpose? And in the past, gas has factored very high. We haven't run the data from those results yet, but I suspect that we'll see gas being a much lower percentage of people that are crossing the border just to fill up on gas.
And that might be a bit of a case of misery loves company, because British Columbia's budget woes under the NDP are, and David Eby and the NDP are as severe in many ways as the budget woes faced by the Ferguson Democrat administration in Olympia, the capital of Washington. And these two jurisdictions are also joined at the hip for another big project, FIFA World Cup 26. Vancouver is hosting 7 matches, Seattle hosting 6 matches. Biggest sporting event in history. Never been done before where you've had 3 nations like this, even though the United States and 11 cities there are hosting about 75% of the matches, and the other quarter of the matches are split between Mexico and Canada. It's still very complex. One thing that they've been able to hang their hat on is that no new stadium has had to be built. There's been renovations. There's renovations here at BC Place Stadium, and some of the other venues are also getting renovations of different types. But the big question is operations. Operations which include moving people between the stadiums and the hotels, the teams and stadiums, their training facilities, getting people in and out of the countries and over the borders. And what are you seeing on the ground there? And of course, you were also at the recent Pacific Northwest Economic Region Summit in Bellevue, where this was also part of the discourse. Where do you see preparations for FIFA World Cup 26? People like to say it's going to happen in less than a year. It's going to be over in less than a year. It's coming down pretty quickly.
This North American trilateral country model with FIFA is that you have situations where people will be crossing the border to attend games on both sides. And our region is the only one where the games basically straddle the border from Vancouver to Seattle. There isn't anywhere else where they're that close together on either side of the border. The other interesting thing about the FIFA model and the host committee model in Seattle and Vancouver is that much of that transportation focus, much of that sort of mobility of moving people around is really focused internally. So how do you get people across the city of Vancouver to the games, for example, and the same with Seattle. And for a while, there was a great gaping hole in the middle, which was how do you get people between Vancouver and Seattle, which of course requires crossing an international border. So there was not a whole lot of, I would say honestly, thought or consideration around that component. And the way the games are structured in Vancouver and Seattle is many of them alternate between the two cities on different days. So for that reason, and if we put the politics of the border aside for a moment, we could really anticipate there's going to be a fair amount of travel along that 99 I-5 corridor if people are wanting to attend games or even like fan zone events or tailgating events on both sides of the border. So that gap in how do we get people across the border has really been taken up by groups like the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. There's another one called the Cascadia Innovation Corridor. And through those initiatives, there's been sort of a stakeholder group that's formed over a year ago, and we've met consistently every week, every other week, involving public, private sector entities to try to make sure that we are thinking about how to get people across the border. How can we educate the traveling public? How can we work with our border agencies to perhaps do something innovative so that people aren't waiting in line like they were for the Taylor Swift concert? Whether that was in Seattle or Vancouver, we saw a very similar trend, which was people getting stuck for hours at a time at the border, and also people not knowing that they might not be able to cross the border. This happened when Taylor Swift played in Vancouver, and many Americans had no idea that they couldn't cross the border into Canada if they had a DUI charge or some other related charge that made them inadmissible. So trying to educate the public is one component, and then trying to bring a little bit of innovation to the extent that we can in a short period of time to how we process people at the border is really a focus of this internal stakeholder group. And I think there is a lot of progress that's been made, and it's really a kind of bright light in an otherwise dark cloud, right? Which is we can come together on something like the FIFA World Cup Games because it benefits both sides of the border for us to work together to make sure that people are able to cross the border smoothly and attend games and attend events and have a good experience in our neighborhoods.
What about that aspect of keeping the border safe and keeping both sides of the border safe, as well as the interoperability, so that both sides of the border are able to work together if an incident does happen?
I mentioned different stakeholder working groups trying to fill that gap of cross-border planning. And recently, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region held an event in Bellingham in early June, which brought together emergency management personnel from both sides of the border, some virtually, some in person, to make sure that those communication platforms, those pathways were still strong. And if there was things that needed to be improved, we could work through a tabletop exercise and sort of improve those gaps. So I feel like our emergency management personnel, our border agencies have actually been able to maintain pretty strong and pretty functional relations, despite the kind of federal noise going on around them, because they are engaged in kind of everyday tactical operations. They've done these sort of events before, and they have pretty good pathways of communication. Now, on the US side, there are some new challenges that weren't there before, just in the face of requirements around the Trump administration. So our Federal Emergency Management Agency has now sort of tied some conditions onto funding that FEMA and DHS are intertwined. DHS is where our border agencies report to. So there's challenges with that related to immigration enforcement and other initiatives in the U.S. that are sort of coming under the scrutiny of the Trump administration. That's internal to the United States, but to the extent that those agencies are sort of compromised by these new restrictions and these new requirements, which in the state of Washington go against the federal requirements, and that's a whole nother topic we could get into, But to the extent that our U.S. agencies are facing challenges that could inhibit our ability, of course, to work with our Canadian counterparts. But I do feel like those relationships are strong and continue to be sort of less problematized maybe than some of these other issues around trade and travel.
Do you think that the public safety side of things is also in order? Are the two sides dealing with each other the way they should on that aspect too?
Yes, but I think we also have challenges around what I would call sort of a border blindness. So if you remember the Nooksack River floods several years ago, there was a lot of collaboration around those floods, whether that was allowing Canadian trucks to come down into the U.S. to bypass some road closures that happened very quickly. And that happened almost in sort of a handshake way between the U.S. and Canada. But at the same time, we don't have a floodplain map that captures this cross-border nature of flooding. So we don't quite have the data or use the data in a way that we should that would allow us to be more resilient against planning for these natural disasters. But I think our response to the natural disasters is strong because we do have really strong working relationships. And I also think that disaster response and natural disaster preparedness, whether it's forest fires or these other things that you mentioned, is perhaps another bright spot in our continued collaboration, because these are events that, of course, know no borders, and we have to work together to plan for these and to respond to them, because it makes our communities on both sides more resilient. So politics aside, you know, hurt feelings aside, even the economics aside, these are shared challenges that really require shared solutions in order for our communities on both sides to be more resilient.
And do you think that just general border security has improved? We've seen Canada take a little bit more of a serious approach since Donald Trump returned and made fentanyl a big issue. Of course, the statistics don't say that fentanyl is a big issue across the border coming from Canada and the United States. But I like to say that the transnational criminals do not file declarations of contraband. So we don't exactly know how much is going across the border. But still, do you think that Canada's response has been positive in at least portraying a stronger face towards transnational crime? You know, they've rented the helicopters. There's a move to hire more border staff. One thing we haven't seen, of course, is what we haven't had for about three decades or so, is a dedicated ports police force here in Canada. You know, the Seattle-Tacoma ports police numbers about 150, and there is zero dedicated police officers on the ports here in British Columbia. There are Canada Border Service Agency agents who do go to the ports, but as we heard from Delta Port, that only about 1% of the containers are actually searched.
Two different issues going on here. One is Canada's sort of external border policy, not necessarily between the U.S. and Canada, but in Canadian ports from abroad. I think that is probably where the most gains can be made, especially the example that you mentioned with port containers not being probably as scrutinized as they could be in many of the precursor materials for things like fentanyl coming from outside of North America. But when it comes to the Canada-US border relationship, which I think would be the second challenge, I think the whole problem was framed in a really unfortunate way, because the Canada-US border has functioned best and been best managed when we've done it collaboratively. And this idea that an open border is an insecure border, I think, is actually a false one. I think we've been able to have, I wouldn't say open because it's not an open border, but I think we've been able to have a relatively undefended border because it has been a fairly well-managed border. And we've been able to do things like have integrated border enforcement teams, have the Ship Rider program, where the US and Canada are working side by side, sharing intelligence, making these advancements, and doing a lot of this stuff actually away from the border, because the actual borderline is typically not where we want to be solving these problems, right? We want to be identifying them away from the border so they never actually cross the border. And I think the way that the Trump administration framed the problem was really sort of pointing a finger at Canada to say, you need to do more, but this is really a two-way relationship. And I was always a little bit confused about the way it was framed, because, you know, blaming Canada for what's coming into the United States is really a U.S. border issue, not a Canadian border issue per se. So the extent to which, yes, Canada has responded, Canada's thrown money at the border, but this hasn't been done in a sort of integrated, collaborative way. And I don't think that does much to strengthen our border relationship. When you have such a long land border, there has to be ways to manage it that aren't necessarily at the borderline. And the US and Canada have not had a bilateral border accord since the Beyond the Border Accord, which really ran its course by the time the Trump administration came in, the first Trump administration came into office. So we have not had a new policy framework to guide that collaborative and integrative border management sort of approach. And I think that has been a real problem for the last, you know, 8+ years, really, in that we're not dedicating our space and our time to doing that. And that really played out, I also think, during the COVID border restrictions, when Canada and the US, we had this agreement in place, and I use air quotes when I say that, because the agreement was very, very limited. And we did not innovate coming out of that experience, where after 9/11, we really innovated together. We developed these joint programs. And again, that's where our border security has been strongest, is where we're sharing that capacity and we're sharing that intelligence. And I think we're in a pretty weak situation on the border, and this sort of unilateral approach really highlights that.
The fate of Point Roberts, a unique community anywhere along the 49th parallel, connected to Delta, but not connected to Washington State.
Yeah, Point Roberts is sort of the ephemeral challenge. And before I move into that, I do just want to touch on your point on there is a lot of Canadians that live in Point Roberts. There's a lot of dual citizens in Point Roberts. And even in Whatcom County, we have a lot of Canadian-owned businesses. So when we think about these challenges in terms of sort of Americans versus Canadians, we're really not engaging with the complexity, which is, you know, Canadians boycotting, for example, travel to Point Roberts actually hurts Canadian businesses as well. It actually hurts Canadian homeowners as well, because we are so intertwined. I recently read a report about the Canadian Duty Free Association and how much those businesses are struggling because there aren't people crossing the border, and in both directions, but mostly Canadians. So these challenges that we face are really intertwined, and Point Roberts is probably sort of the quintessential example of that. And look, I don't think there's a good solution to what we do with Point Roberts. During the COVID pandemic, the state of Washington gave grants to the international marketplace there, gave financial support to some of the businesses. Bellingham themselves, I believe it was our port, provided a ferry so that Point Roberts residents could get directly from Point Roberts to mainland US. I mean, these are things that are very expensive and really sort of plugging the dike, so to say, because they're not going to solve the underlining sort of fundamental challenge of Point Roberts, which is that it's completely dependent on the border, which wasn't really functioning during COVID. Their economy is very dependent on Canadians, which aren't coming now for other reasons. So, you know, I don't know how we solve the challenge of Point Roberts. I did receive an email recently from Brian Calder, a very vocal activist there in Point Roberts, who is sort of raising this old point, which is maybe Point Roberts should just be part of Canada because it would simplify everything. I don't see that happening, but honestly, it'd probably be the best solution to that challenge because it is such a unique situation, and they are so, so dependent on not just Canadian travelers, but their electricity, their energy, their water. I mean, almost everything that sustains Point Roberts originates in Canada.
That was my guest, Lori Troutman, director of the Border Policy Research Institute at Western Washington University in Bellingham. For more information, go to bpri.wwu.edu.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw, Taiwanese film pulled from Hong Kong Festival over censorship issue. The Taiwanese movie Family Matters used a term that Beijing rejects, so it was pulled from the CineFan Summer International Film Festival 2025. Taiwan's Chinese language newspapers Liberty Times and United Daily News reported the cancellation was due to the appearance of the term Min Guo, a reference to the Republic of China, Taiwan's official name, which is not recognized by China. In ABC News Australia, slot machine giant Mounties accused of letting gamblers wager $140 million using dirty money. It is the first licensed club group targeted by the nation's Financial Crime Intelligence Agency. It is accused of turning over almost $140 million from 10 gamblers considered high risk of money laundering and counterterrorism financing. Mounties' network of about 1,400 poker machines had $4.17 billion fed through them from 2019 to 2023. In Kyoto news, Hiroshima urges youth to stand up against nukes on 80th A-bomb anniversary. Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba said in the ceremony that it is Japan's mission as the only country to have experienced the horror of nuclear devastation in war to advance global efforts to realize a world free of nuclear weapons, especially amid increasing divisions over disarmament. A record 120 nations and regions, along with the European Union, took part in the ceremony at the Peace Memorial Park. Around 55,000 people attended. Russia was absent, but Belarus was not. Palestine and Taiwan attended for the first time. Fewer than 100,000 survivors remain. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, a message thread among progressive Portland city councillors reveals they're tightly coordinated. The messages among a block called Peacock provide an unusually clear window into the thinking of a group of councillors who are driving the agenda at Portland City Hall. The 300 pages of text messages obtained through a public records request show that Peacock, short for Progressive Caucus, cheer each other on, while sometimes making snide comments about their centrist adversaries. Four of those councillors are members of the Democratic Socialists of America. In Crosscut, Seattle voters appear poised to renew Democracy Voucher Program. Proposition 1, funded through a property tax, gives Seattle residents four $25 vouchers to distribute to local candidates each election cycle. Voters created Seattle's Democracy Voucher Program in 2015. It gives every Seattle voter $100 in taxpayer funds to donate to candidates in each election. The program cost $3 million last year and was pitched originally as a tool to empower ordinary voters and fight big money in politics in the wake of the controversial Citizens United Supreme Court ruling. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Xi Jinping's outgoing BC envoy urges supporters to be civilian ambassadors for China. And tour boat rescued off West Vancouver, one person taken to hospital. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the memory of Robert Hampton Gray, a little-known British Columbia war hero who died August 9, 1945. Trail-born Gray led an attack on a Japanese Navy ship after the bombing of Nagasaki. He was one of the last Canadians who died in World War II, earning a posthumous Victoria Cross for valor, fighting spirit, and inspiring leadership. August 9th was Robert Hampton Gray Day in BC. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 10th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 10th of August in 1948, Candid Camera debuted on TV on the ABC network, a pioneer in reality TV and comedy. And on the 10th of August in 1971, the Society for American Baseball Research formed in Cooperstown, New York, keeping data and history of the great American game alive. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.